And now for something completely different.
It's a rich man's world. Forget everything you've been told by others before. Get ready for the real deal, the full story. Real talk about money, markets, life. Now, it's The Real Investment Show with Lance Roberts. Presented by RIA Advisors.
And welcome to the show this morning at 6:07 on The Real Investment Show on this pre-hump day edition as we kind of move through the week here. Of course, tomorrow is the 15th. I'll explain why that's important in a second.
It's the Ides of January.
It's the Ides of January. Yes, it is. So yesterday my wife had surgery.
Yes.
And just foot surgery, no big deal.
Yeah.
But we went down there and I was desperate to try to get video in the recovery room just so that I could ask her who her favorite husband was, would clearly be Ryan Reynolds.
Did they see you coming?
I just wanted audio evidence that it was Ryan Reynolds. But nonetheless, they wouldn't let me back there until after she actually recovered.
Oh.
There was like a dual recovery. There was like recovery and then there was recovery, right?
Denied.
So, I know, right? So I have no evidence. But it was all fine. Got home yesterday and so she's, you know, milking it for all it's worth today. Yes, she's got a shoe on her foot and it's propped up and, you know, apparently the doctor says she's fine to walk around on it, but she can't. So it requires lots of attention. This week, Michael Leibowitz, CFA, he's in town. And so we're going to be recording a special podcast today and tomorrow that we'll be putting up on our YouTube channel. So make sure and get by our website, realinvestmentadvice.com. Click on the YouTube channel. Make sure you're subscribed. But Mike and I are going to do a 2020 investment outlook and forecast and basically talk about where the markets are, where we expect them to be, kind of look at some of the things that are going on inside the markets. We'll have that podcast out for you, like I said, later this week. And we'll actually include it in this weekend's newsletter. But if you go by the website, realinvestmentadvice.com, and click on the YouTube channel, subscribe there, we'll automatically update you with all of our videos, podcasts, et cetera, as they come out virtually every day. So we have something for you almost every day of the week. Interesting situation. Cory Booker dropped out of the Democratic race, which is interesting because the Democrats have really kind of posted themselves up on this idea of diversity and equality and all these different types of, you know, climate change and kind of trying to appeal very much to the millennial younger voting class. And if you notice now, you've got Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders leading the race.
Mm-hmm.
With Cory Booker dropping out, it's now just gotten a lot older and whiter.
Right.
So I'm not sure how they're actually feeding into, you know, their platforms, but it is going to be interesting to watch. I mean, with Warren, Sanders, and Biden leading the race, and Biden leading, which is interesting to me, Trump's got this sewn up. This is going to be an easy election. I'm not sure.
Now. Never say never.
No, you were right. Never say never. But
remember,
I'm just not
Hillary.
Sure. Yeah. I'm just not sure how Biden's going to pull this one out of the hat.
I don't either, but still, anything could happen.
I mean, just if the guy shows up, remembers to show up for Election Day, that would be a good thing. I guess if we can get that far.
Either one of those guys.
So, all right. Well, anyway. I mean, Bernie Sanders has already come out and said, I'm probably good for one term. I mean, when you're as old as he is, you're just going, man, if I could make it four more years, if I get elected, it's a win.
You know what we're going to see if that happens? Weekend at Bernie's part three.
Exactly. That's been my fear. They're just going to prop him up in the White House and just say, oh, yeah, he's fine.
He can't see you right now.
Exactly. He's fine. No worries. All right. Anyway, yesterday the markets rallied. Of course, the expectation that we're going to sign this trade deal. And it was interesting because I saw quite a few pieces of analysis out yesterday talking about what is contained in the trade deal. And it's interesting because nobody knows what's in the trade deal. This has not been released yet. And apparently, according to the Chinese, one of the Chinese requests is after they sign the trade deal, that the actual terms of the deal are not going to be released. We'll see. That's just been kind of some of the early rumors. But again, we really don't know what's in the trade deal. The details haven't been released, but you know, they're talking about more agricultural purchases and some type of resolution on IP transfer. But again, no real details about what it is. So this is very up in the air at this moment, but it is expected to be signed on Wednesday. And all that's going to do is pretty much just reset the table in terms of purchases for China back to where we were in 2017. So we've had 2 years of slump in agricultural purchases. That'll kind of reset the table back to what they were buying before in 2017. But it does not reset the table back in terms of tariffs. There are still tariffs on the economy, and that is continuing to be a tax on consumers ultimately. Wage growth dropped sharply over the course of the last 2 months. We've heard a lot about the strong wage growth for the bottom 80% of workers. It was great. In the December wage report, the entire wage growth for 2019 was wiped out, and basically due to negative revisions. So wage growth really hasn't kept up. We've got higher costs coming in, and we are starting to see weaker employment growth. We had 145,000 jobs created in the last employment report. The trend, and now while that's weaker, it also completely revised off what happened in November. But the important thing here is that the trend of employment growth is weaker. And in fact, the entire employment growth for 2019 was one of the weakest that we've had in the last several years. So you are seeing weaker employment growth. You're seeing CFO sentiment as well as CEO sentiment very negative here. Expectations of a weaker economy. But that's all part of what's happened from tariffs. That all really kind of started ramping up after we started this trade war because tariffs impact businesses. So the trade deal does not get rid of tariffs. It does keep new tariffs from being imposed, and it reduces the last round of tariffs by 50%, but the previous tariffs still in place. Now, outside of that, profit growth and earnings growth are not growing. They've pretty much been stagnant last year. We had actually a reduction in reported earnings, but yet the stock market has had a very, very substantial rally because, as we've talked about here on the show before, because of what's happening with the Federal Reserve and the influx of liquidity from the repo operations that started really right here last October. And since the Fed has started their activities, we've had almost a 45-degree slant in the markets. And while that's okay, that's great, right? We've participated in that. We talked about in our newsletter this weekend that, hey, we went in, we took a little bit of profit off the table, just kind of reduced our risk here a little bit, added a little bit of extra cash. Nothing dramatic here, just kind of really trimming around the edges, because the primary reason is that every time the market is as extended as it is now, and when you start getting to the points to where you see these expectations of advances exceed two standard deviations of the markets, that's a technical term, don't worry about it. It just means that you stretch rubber band about as far as you can get. You have corrections almost every single time. So this is why we were talking about taking some money off the table, being a little bit more cautious here. Again, just a pullback of 3 to 5% is all we're talking about here. Probably happens in late January, early February, mid-February, somewhere around there. In the next month or so, we have a 3 to 5% correction. Put that money back to work. But by taking a little bit of money off the table, you can kind of save yourself a little bit of angst when you actually start getting some corrective processes. The issue is that once we get the trade deal signed, that's done and off the table. It's kind of a buy the rumor, sell the news type event. And so we may see some sell-off after the actual signing of the trade deal. If it does happen this week, we'll see. But outside of that, again, just be a little bit cautious here. The markets have had a great, terrific run over the last several months. Pull a bit of that money off the table, just like a good poker player, right? Time to take some chips off the table and maybe cash them in a bit. That's how you survive the long-term game in investing and poker, by the way. So be right back after the break. I'm your host, Lance Roberts, and you're listening to The Real Investment Show. Don't go away.
Real Investment Show podcasts are now available on iTunes.
Listen anyplace, anytime
at itunes.com.
If the stock market were a highway, 2019 was a smooth ride. Don't expect the same in 2020. If you're 3 to 5 years from retiring or have just retired, you need to attend our next RIA Right Lane Retirement Class, where we'll cover Social Security, Medicare, long-term care, and now, with the passage of the SECURE Act, why creating a tax-friendly paycheck in retirement is more important than ever. Our next class is January 25th in the Woodlands. Register online now at RIAAdvisors.com. Get in the right lane for retirement. RIAAdvisors.com.
Welcome this morning. It is 6:19 as we get the Tuesday edition of the Real Investment Show underway. So, a couple of things. This weekend, we wrote an article called This Is Nuts, and talking a little bit about the extension of the markets, technically speaking, as you know, market prices have, and I was just discussing a second ago, market prices had gotten really, really, really ahead of themselves. And we've had a very, very big run here. The hardest part for investors to do is to step back from the poker table, right? What separates a successful poker player or gambler, period, from kind of the retail gambler is the ability to understand risk and reward and be willing to pass up potential opportunity in order to protect capital. And that's how they survive long-term, you know, playing for the long-term, and they win more often than they lose. The reason that Las Vegas is very successful and Las Vegas makes billions of dollars every year is because the average Joe comes in to try their luck at blackjack or poker or, you know, craps, whatever it is. And we all fancy ourselves gamblers, right? And it's always interesting. I talk to people that come back from Vegas and go, how'd you do? And they go, oh, I won. Yeah. Sure you did. The issue is that, you know, the average person goes in and plays. And look, we're just playing for fun. I get it, right? But we don't know when to walk away from the table. And so whatever we wind up winning, we wind up eventually giving back to the house. And this is why there's the old saying, the house always wins. It's because the average person doesn't understand how to measure risk. And we use the poker analogy a lot in our business and what we talk about here, because it really reflects what goes on in the financial markets. You are a speculator. And that's just that's just the basis of it. Because, you know, if you're Warren Buffett, and this is where people confuse Warren Buffett. See, Warren Buffett buys entire companies. So he has a seat on the board and he can direct the growth of the company over time. And he can combine one company with another company that he owns, create synergies, etc. So he has control over his investment. And when you have control over an investment like that, if something's not working out well, you make changes, you make adjustments, you do things to make the company grow. And you can grow your way to success over time. For the average investor, all we can do is simply buy something and hope it goes up in price. We have no control over the stocks that we buy. We don't have, you know, if I buy shares in Apple, great. I've got no control over what the company does. If Tim Cook goes crazy all of a sudden, I don't have any ability to offset that. All I can do is simply sell my shares. That's all the control I have over my portfolio is simply buy what I buy and sell to protect my gains. And this is why we talk about these things about, you know, taking profits, selling, taking an active role in your money, because these are your savings. And I don't know about you personally, but, you know, I work hard to make money. Brent works hard. You know, Russell Sherrill over at the station, he works hard for his paycheck. And when you have these savings, remember the amount of work that you put in to generate these savings. And so when you start investing them, understand that you're taking risk with money you've worked very hard for. We tend to lose that connection in this kind of gambling mentality. And it's kind of the same way that happens when you walk into a casino, except the difference when we walk into a casino,
is that we know we're probably going to lose our money. So we go in with this idea, like, okay, I'm going to spend $200 or whatever the number is that hits your fancy. But you kind of go in with the expectation that if I lose this money, okay, I had fun, I enjoyed myself, and it was, you know, this was the cost of entertainment. Your portfolio is very much the same way, except you don't want to lose that money. These are your savings. You're trying to grow these savings over time. And a lot of people accept this very cavalier attitude about their investments and savings. Like, well, I'm going to buy this stock, and if it crashes, you know, so what? You know, took a shot, right? Could have made money with it. But when you destroy capital, you can't make that up. You know, people say, well, you know, the markets have recovered back to where they were, you know, prior to some period, right? So in 2008, the markets finally got back to where they were in 2014 on a total return basis. And everybody goes, well, see, the market's fully recovered. So if you had a loss in 2008, you got it back by 2014. Well, you really didn't, because you lost several things along the way. The first thing that you lost was time. And time is the one thing that we don't have the ability to get more of. So if I have 20 years to retirement, or 30 years to retirement, or 10 years to retirement, whatever that number is, where I'm going to need my capital and my savings to support my lifestyle in retirement, if I destroy 5, 6, 7, 10 years of that time frame, just getting back to even, I've lost that time. Now I no longer have 10 years or 20 years or 30 years to get to retirement. I have 10 years less than that. And for a lot of people that were ready to retire in 2000, they weren't able to retire. They got back to even in 2008, then lost 50% again. They got back to even in 2014, 14 years of going nowhere. So if you were ready to retire in 2008, you weren't able to do so. And this is the problem with losses. Losses have a very, very big impact on your future retirement. The other side is that, yes, markets do recover over time, but you lose the opportunity cost of that money during that time frame. So yes, while the markets got back to even after 6-7 years, you lost the opportunity to grow that money over that 6 or 7 year period. You can't get that back either. So just getting back to even is not an investment strategy. And over the last few years, yes, the markets have had great gains. And this is a hot streak. So if we're playing poker and, you know, we're on a hot streak, this is where investors, you know, poker players go, man, I can't leave the table. I'm hot, right? Got to keep rolling the dice. Got to keep betting on the cards. Eventually, and it's just a function of time, because this is just odds at work, the hot streak is going to end. And that's when you have to know to walk away from the table. The problem is that most poker players and gamblers don't walk away from the table. They go, well, I was hot a minute ago, it'll come back. And before the hot streak comes back, they're generally out of money. And that's why the house always wins. Ultimately, the stock market always wins. And what I mean by that is the stock market is the house. And investors have repeatedly lost a tremendous amount of opportunity in the markets because of not understanding that there are times that you need to walk away from the table and reduce risk. This is one of those times. Valuations are extremely extended. Second highest level valuations in history. Profit growth has been flat. Earnings growth has been flat. So what's been driving the markets over the last couple of years is simply people betting on an expectation that economic and earnings growth is going to recover. But we are now 127 months into this economic cycle. It is the longest economic cycle on record. It's also the weakest economic cycle on record. But expectations are, by the gamblers in the market, is that don't worry about the soft patch we're in, because it's going to turn around and come back. We're not going to have a recession. Maybe that's the case. But this is kind of the same analogy as having had a hot hand over the last few years, and it's going to come back. What if it doesn't? And the issue is do you run out of money before it eventually does? And this is why, and as we will talk about after the break a little bit, you know, why we wrote about this article today, which is part two of our series called This Is Nuts, is if you look at how investors are positioning themselves in the markets, they are all at the poker table and they are all in. every hand. And the risk with that ultimately is one bad hand, one thing goes wrong, and the amount of trouble that investors will be in over time is going to be very, very dramatic very quickly. Investors have picked up a sense that there is an immovable object for the markets. And we'll talk about what that is when we come back from the break. Don't go away.
Follow us on Twitter at Real Investment Advice or go to realinvestmentadvice.com.
If the stock market were a highway, 2019 was a smooth ride. Don't expect the same in 2020. If you're 3 to 5 years from retiring or have just retired, you need to attend our next RIA Advisors Right Lane Retirement Class, where we'll cover Social Security, Medicare, long-term care, and now, with the passage of the SECURE Act, why creating a tax-friendly paycheck in retirement is more important than ever. Our next class is January 25th in the Woodlands. Get in the right lane for retirement. Register online now at RIAAdvisors.com. RIAAdvisors.com.
And welcome back to the show at 6:33 on this Tuesday edition, talking a little bit about investing markets and kind of where we are. And here's the interesting thing. So we wrote this article out today. It's on our website, realinvestmentadvice.com, talking about this is nuts. And what we mean by that is that the markets have been rising, not because of fundamental issues, right? So, you know, if the economy's growing, you've got strong strong earnings growth, strong corporate profits, those type of things, you would expect prices to be rising. Those should go together. What you have currently is that you have weaker economic growth. You've got flat corporate profits over the last several years, actually, and you've got weaker earnings growth and weaker earnings growth expectations going into the rest of this year. So stocks are trading well above their value. And this is why price to earnings ratios are pushing 30 times earnings currently. And while there's nothing wrong with that in the short term and looking at valuations as a market timing tool, et cetera, terrible idea. What valuations tell you is what you pay for something today is the value that you will get in the future. And when you're paying 30 times earnings for something today, your future return on that investment is going to be substantially lower. But the reason that markets are running up is not because of the fundamental structure of the markets. So the markets aren't running up because of trade deals. The markets aren't running up because of, you know, political movement, whatever it is. The markets are running up because of the Federal Reserve. And we've talked about this before. The Federal Reserve is injecting a tremendous amount of liquidity into the markets. That money goes to hedge funds that then leverage that money up. They take a $10 billion load of cash and leverage that 20 or 30 times. So all that money comes back into the markets. And the reason that the Federal Reserve has been so adamant about providing this liquidity over the last several months is because they can't afford another long-term type, long-term capital management type event, which was back in 1998. You've got a lot of hedge funds now. You know, long-term capital management was, you know, a $100 billion problem. You're talking about hedge funds, multiple hedge funds now that are substantially bigger than that by magnitudes. So it's not just one problem. It is a constellation of long-term capital managements that exists currently in the markets that could create a credit problem. And this is the one thing the Federal Reserve is terrified about. So they're providing this liquidity. the problem, and we've got an article coming out on this on Thursday for the Federal Reserve, is that they have now gotten trapped within their own trap. Now, investors think that this is an immovable object. The investor sentiment suggests that they are totally reliant now, that the Federal Reserve has everything under control. They will not allow a recession or a market decline of any sort. So, hey, I've got to be long equities. I don't disagree with that premise in the short term. It certainly seems that way. And as we discussed earlier in the show, there's been a 45% advance, you know, angular advance in the markets, you know, since October when the Federal Reserve started these massive liquidity injections. So there's certainly a correlation, and nobody's denying that. But the markets have come to believe and to depend upon the Federal Reserve to be the quote-unquote lender of last resort, support of last resort for the markets. And that is a dangerous assumption to a degree, because you're now completely avoiding the whole reason that you invest to start with, which is to invest in companies that are growing capital, that make money, so that your future return on investment will be higher. But yet, if you look at what's happened in the markets over the last couple of months, the stocks that are rallying the most are the stocks that make no money. They have the least amount of fundamental value. They're very risky investments. But those are the ones that are running up because they had a lot of short interest in them. Those shorts have been forced to cover. That's been driving the prices higher. But this is what you see, right? And there's two things that have occurred. So in this past weekend's newsletter, in part one of This Is Nuts, we talked about the technical extensions of the markets, put call ratios and things that suggest that investors are extremely complacent about their investments. Well, in today's article, we pick up on part two of that story, which is how investors are allocating themselves. And it doesn't matter whether you look at individual investors or institutional investors or mutual funds or hedge funds, it doesn't matter where you look. Everybody is completely long the markets. In other words, their exposure to equities is now at some of the highest levels on records. Deviations from long-term means are extremely extended. And when you have this combination where everybody's literally on one side of the boat, right? Boats tend to tip over, which is why you always have to kind of balance things. But everybody's currently betting that the next hand being dealt will be a winning hand. And they're betting all in every hand. That's basically what that tells you, is they have all their chips in the table betting on that that there will not be an event anytime in the near future. They are that confident about the markets. Now, the one thing about investors, particularly at turning points in the markets, market peaks and market bottoms, they are very, very wrong. I'm not saying investors are wrong currently. What I'm saying is that when everybody expects, Bob Farrell, probably one of the legendary investors of all time, he had a saying, he says, when all experts agree, something else is bound to happen. And it's pretty much just a bit of the contrarian investing idea that there are times where you kind of want to bet against the herd. If everybody's doing one thing, maybe it's an opportunity to do something a little different. And that's where money tends to get made in markets. Market investors tend to make money by betting on things that people haven't recognized yet. And if everybody's on one side of the boat, if everybody's kind of running off the cliff together, reminds me of what my mom used to say, right? You go, well, everybody's doing it. Well, if everybody's running off a cliff, would you do it too? That's kind of what's happening in the markets, right? Maybe your mom's right. You know, everybody's running off the market, but you know, if we actually want to make money, maybe this is a time to think a little bit differently about where money might go to next. You know, Wayne Gretzky, the famous hockey player, once said, they asked him a question. They says, well, how are you so good at it? And he says, well, I don't skate to where the puck is. I skate to where it's going to be. And that's a very, very valid point, which is, as investors, our job and our ability to make money is really best served by trying to figure out where the markets are going to go to next and where that might be. So where are some of those areas that have been underperforming, right? Energy has been underperforming for the last almost 2 years now relative to the rest of the market. There's actually value in some of these energy companies. And we've been doing some analysis on that on our website, riapro.net, where we have been kind of digging into the energy sector, looking for opportunities. We haven't made any bets there yet to any great degree because there's still some concerns over oil prices, supply, demand, economic growth, those type of things. But there's eventually going to be a very, very good opportunity in that area. One of the other things that is also an opportunity is on a bet against a strengthening dollar. The dollar's been very, very strong over the course of the last couple of years. And that's been supportive of asset prices and supportive of the economy. That's been good. But with some of the policies that are going on now, with some of the attitudes towards kind of the U.S. in itself, there's a risk that we're going to see a reversion in flows into the U.S. dollar, out of the U.S. dollar, which would be a weaker U.S. dollar. And that provides for other opportunities. A weaker U.S. dollar is good for things like commodities, gold, precious metals in general. Weaker dollars tend to make those stronger in the U.S. because those commodities are traded in dollars all around the world. So if our dollar weakens, we get more value out of those assets. So there's some opportunities, and these areas have been languishing over the courses of the last couple of years. So from a contrarian basis, right? So when we start looking for where opportunity is, the goal is to look at where the markets are now and figure out where the puck's going to be next. And the risk is that with all investors betting that stock market prices can only go higher and they're taking the most amount of risk that they can do currently, that the next place the puck is going to go is probably not stocks. But again, it's about timing and risk management. It's just something about the articles on the website today, realinvestmentadvice.com. It's called This Is Nuts Part 2. It also includes our 15 rules of risk management. So if you really just want to try to figure out how to manage your own risk better, we provide the 15 rules that we use internally is in that article as well. This Is Nuts Part 2. It's on the website now, realinvestmentadvice.com. We'll be right back. We're leaving together, but still this farewell. And maybe we'll come back to earth again. The Real Investment Advice Blog. It's required reading for the informed investor. Catch it today at realinvestmentadvice.com.
If the stock market were a highway, 2019 was a smooth ride. Don't expect the same in 2020. If you're 3 to 5 years from retiring or have just retired, you need to attend our next RIA Right Lane Retirement Class, where we'll cover Social Security, Medicare, long-term care, and now, with the passage of the SECURE Act, why creating a tax-friendly paycheck in retirement is more important than ever. Our next class is January 25th in the Woodlands. Register online now at RIAAdvisors.com. Get in the right lane for retirement. RIAAdvisors.com.
And welcome back to the show this morning. It is 6:47 as we get ready to wrap up the show. So a couple of interesting stories here just to kind of cap off the hour. The U.S. budget deficit blows out to a 9-year high in the first quarter of fiscal 2020. Is anybody surprised? Raise your hand, please. Well, not while you're driving. We've been talking about this for a while, is that we've been unable to do any type of fiscal budget in Congress. The goal of Congress has simply just now become to see how much money we can spend and do it as quickly as possible. Don't worry about actually paying for the debt down the road. That's completely okay. Total December spending of $349 billion was 7.5% higher than a year earlier, with the biggest outlays for the 1 month as follows. Social Security, $88 billion. National defense was $62 billion. Health was $49 billion. Income security, $39 billion. Net interest, $34 billion. Net interest, that's interest on your debt, which was more than Medicare spending for the month of $26 billion, so forth and so on. As we talked about before, about 98 cents of every dollar that we bring in terms of tax revenue, right, what you pay in income taxes, actually doesn't, that just goes to mandatory spending. That's Social Security, welfare, prescription drug benefits, and interest on the debt. All the other stuff, right, healthcare spending, defense spending, all that, that comes out of debt. So that's why we're running in excess of $1 trillion in debt right now, and a deficit right now, and that will continue to ramp up over the course of this year. And so the first 3 months of fiscal 2020, total outlays rose to $1.163 billion. Receipts were only $806 billion. And, you know, the problem is that, remember, we were sold the tax cut bill on the idea that this was going to create really strong economic growth. And even though we cut taxes, that would lead to higher tax revenue, which actually did not turn out to be the case. And the problem for the average American is that real interest, real inflation is actually rising, and what their cost of living is going up at a time where the amount of government support is also increasing. One out of four families receive some form of government subsidy. And, you know, this is problematic from the standpoint only that we are not employing policies that creates a better economic prescription for the broad swath of Americans. And this is why, 80% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we talked about the problems with corporate tax cuts when they were first passed. We talked about where that money would wind up, which would be in share buybacks, which has been the case. So we've had this booming stock market, yet that has largely bypassed the vast majority of Americans, which don't actually participate in the markets. It may seem that way, but it's not the case. So, you know, this is, but again, this, you know, the problem that we've talked about here on the show is that fiscal conservatism, which is what Republicans, quote unquote, have established their platforms on. And don't worry, when we get into the upcoming presidential debates and those type of things, it'll be interesting here because we'll hear a lot about, you know, getting the budget under control, getting debt under control. We'll hear a lot of that talk. But again, that never happens, right? And the reason is because we've come to this idea that, well, it's easier to do deficit spending to create economic growth than actually try to do the things that actually create organic economic growth. And if you take a look at it over the last 2 years, almost the entirety of the economic growth that we've had has come from deficit spending by the government. So, you know, the problem, though, is, and again, is that when you take a look at what, you know, Democrats are prescribing, more debt, using, we're going to pay for free college, free healthcare, whatever it is, it's all free because we're just going to use debt to pay for it. What is always forgotten is two things. One, the debt does have to be repaid. There's this attitude that, well, we can just forgive the debt at some point, right? You know, it's so what? We run up a couple of $1 trillion of debt. Who cares? We'll just forgive it at some point, right? We're just going to forgive college debt, as an example. We'll forgive student loan debt. Okay, but once you do that, you destroy your credibility, and this is credit, right? Our credit rating with the world right now is AAA. People hide their money in U.S. Treasuries. Why? For safety and security. We have the largest net inflows on record right now coming into U.S. treasuries from all around the world. Why? Because safety and security. What happens to the value of your currency and the value of your country when you simply say, we're just not going to pay that back? Where does that money go? It doesn't come here anymore. So all of a sudden, your friends and neighbors that you rely on to buy your debt, to fund your deficit spending, are no longer going to buy your debt. This has a huge ramification of impacts all across the economic spectrum, from soaring interest rates, which impacts economic growth. None of it's good. And so this kind of cavalier attitude that, A, we can just print money and pay off our debt, no big deal, as long as you don't have inflation, or that we'll just magically just, you know, wipe our debt away and just say, eh, pfft, whatever, all has very negative consequences. There's no upside to that. And, you know, this idea that we can just print, you know, just issue debt and print money to pay it under the assumption there's no inflation is that you've got to have a real measure of inflation to begin with. And if we take a look at the way we calculate inflation now, there's clearly a problem between the way the government calculates inflation and the average family faces inflation. And inflation is different for different age groups, different areas of the country. You know, it costs substantially more to live in California and New York than it does in Texas. And so how is there this one measure of inflation that is extremely low that we all abide into and say, okay, well, if we just print money to the moon and we keep adjusting the way we calculate for inflation, we can keep that suppressed. So we just keep printing money. But yet you destroy the economic fabric and the process. So, you know, this is the problem of where we're heading down this road. And you know, we've seen this in countries before. Japan is a great example of what's happened, right? They can't generate and have not generated in almost 30 years now economic growth above 1% or 2%. Rolling recessions that occur. They have, you know, a very weak economic demographic that's coming up. The average individual, you know, child can't move out of the house because they can't afford to. So multi-generational families are living together. They've got a very busted pension plan. A lot of the same similarities that we have here in the United States. But yet we're not willing to look at Japan as a roadmap and say that's where we're going to end up if we get on this road. But again, for politicians who are in office for a short period of time, it's better to do these things, right? To spend money, not worry about the debt and deficit, because it's not my problem after I'm out of office. You know, 4 more years, Trump's out of office. So what he does over the next 4 years, who cares, right? As long as it's good right now. And this is why, though, we can't ever make changes, politically speaking, in order to do what's better for the country as a whole over the long term, because A, it's not politically expedient and I won't get reelected, or I won't get elected to start with. If I run on a platform of reforming Social Security and fixing some of these problems, I won't get elected. When I'm in office, it's not politically expedient to do these things because the pain that it will generate in the short term will make you a very unfavorable president or very unfavorable congressman because you put this pressure upon the economy. See, we all want to complain about the fact that we know this is coming. I mean, you hear this from, you know, the Republican Party all across the spectrum, right? This is what's coming, right? This is going to happen. But we're not going to do anything about it today. It's the next guy's job. And the problem is we keep kicking that can down the road. So, you know, we'll figure this out. But again, keep a watch on what's happening with the deficits. We talked about this on the show. In 2020, we're going to have the biggest deficit on record for the U.S. government at a time where we are running an expansion. And the question becomes simply what happens and what is going to be the alternative when we actually get into the next recession and we need to deficit spend in order to try to bail out the recession. And see, and this is the risk of not following Keynes's theory. See, Keynes' economic theory of monetary policy is you run a deficit in a recession, but you revert that to a surplus during your expansion so you can have that ability during the next recession to do deficit spending and help support and help, kind of temper the depth of the recession. The problem is now is we're running a near record deficit now, and it will be a record by the time the next recession hits. So the ability to temper that recession is going to be much more limited. All right, enough of that. According to the first Briton to go into space, Dr. Helen Sharman, she says extraterrestrials do exist, and it could be even possible that they are among us on Earth. She says that it's not far-fetched to believe that there is intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, because apparently it's not in Congress. And just for my wife, who is a big Christmas tree fanatic, there is a new article out today that will thrill her. If you think it's time to take down your Christmas tree, think again, because Valentine Day trees are now in. And this is basically just redecorating your Christmas tree all in red and putting Valentine's Day presents underneath the tree. And really, let's just be honest. This is just for people that are too lazy to take down their Christmas tree from Christmas. So
I might be tempted.
Yes. Well, I'm thinking that I can extend this into May and have a birthday tree.
Yes. And a 4th of July tree.
And a you're on to something here.
Every month could have one.
Let's just grow a tree inside the house. Wraps up the show for today. I'm your host, Lance Roberts. We'll be back tomorrow with Danny Ratliff right here on The Real Investment Show. In the meantime, get by the website, get our latest blog post on This Is Nuts Part 2, talking about the markets and money and your investing and our 15 management rules for risk. It's all in the article today on the website, realinvestmentadvice.com. Send us your questions and comments and let us know what we can do for you. Always happy to help. And, of course, we'll be back tomorrow with more of The Real Investment Show. Stick around, though, because Chris Salcedo, he's coming right up. It's a rich man's world.